evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanz in Washington on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, May 30th, 2023. Sudan's two generals continue to fight despite ceasefire extension.
The one-week ceasefire helped calm the situation a little bit, but there were serious violations by both parties. The Sudan Armed Forces conducted air surveillance and air raids in violation of certain provisions of the ceasefire.
And an American Hollywood star is in South Sudan to encourage reconciliation and peaceful coexistence.
I want to see things and always see things. So I've been here many, many, many times, all the way through most of our trainings. So it's a way for me to be able to connect.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The head of the UN Refugee Agency told Reuters Monday an estimated 1 million people might flee Sudan by October, risking an increasing people trafficking and spreading of weapons across a fragile region. The United Nations say more than 350,000 people have already fled across Sudan's borders since fighting between Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces erupted on April 15, with most heading to Egypt, Chad, and South Sudan. More than 1 million people have been displaced within Sudan, which has a population of 49 million people. Reuters says reports that heavy fighting has continued through residential areas of the capital Khartoum, and violence has also flared in western region of Darfur. Reuters quotes the refugee agency's head, Filippo Grandi, in an interview in Cairo after a visit to the border with Sudan, as saying, quote, "This projection that in the next few months will reach those high figures may even be conservative," Grandi told Reuters. He says, quote, "At the beginning, I did not believe it would be, but now I'm beginning to be worried." End of quote. The United Nations bordering Sudan, the nations bordering Sudan include South Sudan, Central African Republic, Ethiopia, Libya, all affected by their own recent conflicts. Grandi told Reuters the collapse of law and order in Sudan could make people move out of the country and provide a good ground for human trafficking, while small arms will continue to spread across borders that will endanger violence. Mediation to address Sudan's 1 month and a half long conflict is still in its early stages. That's according to Suleiman Baldo, director of the think tank Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker. The Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces agreed last night to extend a 7-day U.S.-Saudi brokered ceasefire for another 5 days. Baldo tells VOA's Nabil Biagio, while ceasefire has helped slow down raging conflict and destruction of the capital Khartoum, other parts of the country has been marred with serious violations of international and humanitarian laws.
A 1 week ceasefire helped calm the situation a little bit, but there were serious violations by both parties. The Sudan Armed Forces conducted air surveillance and air raids in violation of certain provisions of the ceasefire. They conducted aerial bombings. The Rapid Support Forces redeployed their elements to attack the army position, again in violation of provisions of the ceasefire. Both parties also continued to occupy public buildings and prevent access to facilities that are necessary for the well-being and survival of the population, such as water stations and power generation stations that were damaged or destroyed by the fighting. However, the last period that we compared to earlier, these fires presented better observation in terms of about 3 days of calmer, less intense fighting in Khartoum. The main thing, the ceasefire is about humanitarian access and protection of civilians, and nothing has been done about this for the largest concentration of civilians in the capital, Khartoum, of 7 million inhabitants. Many have left, you know, tens of thousands, but still there are millions who are trapped.
Do you expect to see more of the same with the 5-day extension?
Well, like the mediators, you know, we are now looking at this as a one-step-at-a-time process, hoping that the parties will come to their senses and meet their obligations under international humanitarian law of protecting civilians, allowing access to them, giving humanitarian workers safe access to service trapped populations, and to allow the free movement of these populations if they so wish. This has not been the case until now, as I said, in Khartoum, and you can only hope that in the less than a week extension of 5 days, the parties will show better compliance with their obligations under the ceasefire terms.
And these are short-term humanitarian ceasefires, like you mentioned. What does it take to achieve a permanent ceasefire and possibly move towards a political settlement to this conflict?
This is a very early stage. You know, it's really about protection of civilians and salvaging civilians who are in the crossfire zones. However, the mediators are eager to get to the next phase of separation of forces and the actual deployment of observers of the compliance with the ceasefire. This hasn't been the case because the forces of the two parties are interlocked in an urban warfare, in which the rapid support forces occupy large swathes of Khartoum, embedding itself in residential areas. The army, by this bombing from the air and through artillery at positions of the RSF, has really added to the misery of the population and destroyed private residences and public you know, facilities.
I know you said we are in the early stages of this process, but what possible outcomes or do we have at the end of this conflict from what you see? Because some people talk about doomsday scenarios, destruction of Khartoum and the country descending into full-blown civil war, or returning to the previous arrangement with Burhan, General Burhan as the head of state, and General Dagalo as his deputy. What outcomes do we have here?
I don't see a scenario whereby people could return to the simple iteration an arrangement in which the two generals would have any role in the political dispensation in the post-conflict era. They have completely discredited themselves. They should be shunned by the international community and isolated for their, role in actually destroying Khartoum. This is not a doomsday scenario. It's actually happening. When you look at the level of destruction that is occurring daily in the capital, not only because of the fighting, but also because of systematic looting and arson. So the level of destruction, I don't think the international community apprehends how Sudan has been bombed into, a failed state. There is no functioning state in Sudan today, and it will be very difficult to revive it in the post-conflict era, even if the fighting stops today. And therefore, I think that whatever government would come after the conflict would have to be a civilian government, getting back, yes, to the scenario of the army and the security institutions, exiting power, ceding all their economic holdings in terms of publicly owned enterprise, government-owned enterprises, coming under the financial sovereignty of the government and not controlled of budget by the army and by the private companies of the rapid support forces.
That's Suleiman Baldo, director of Sudan's Transparency and Policy Tracker. He spoke with Nabil Biagio this past hour from the U.S. state of New Jersey. Medical care providers in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp say an ongoing cholera outbreak is a looming catastrophe. Doctors Without Borders has described the six-month-long cholera outbreak as the worst yet amid an influx of refugees from Somalia. Victoria Munga reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Médecins Sans Frontières, popularly known as Doctors Without Borders, told a news conference Tuesday that a cholera outbreak in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp is approaching an epidemic and that urgent attention in the areas of water and sanitation is needed. Dr. Nitya Uderaj is the medical coordinator.
The humanitarian conditions there are already at its limit. So when you have an outbreak like cholera or measles, it's literally the last straws that bring it to the breaking point. Which is why today we want to bring focus that the humanitarian situation is already precarious. We would like to bring attention that after 6 months, if the outbreak still continues, it's not normal.
The cholera outbreak hit East Africa's largest refugee camp last November. At least 5 people have died since then. The Dadaab complex in Kenya's northeastern region is home to over 300,000 refugees, most from neighboring Somalia. Their numbers have exceeded capacity due to the extended drought in Somalia. At least 67,000 more refugees arrived in the camp last year, according to national data, putting pressure on already limited resources. Doctors Without Borders country director Hassan Mayaki explains.
Today, according to humanitarian organization working in the camp, almost half the camp population have no access to functional latrine, leading to open defection in and around the camp, which raises the risk of disease outbreaks.
Kenya's Ministry of Health carried out cholera vaccinations at the camp, but the doctors say curbing the outbreak remains elusive without sanitation and hygiene intervention. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Juba, where Forest Whitaker, an American actor, Hollywood star, and the founder of the Whitaker Peace and Development Initiative, is in South Sudan's capital, Juba, to assess the impact of his organization's programs aimed at reconciliation and peace building amongst communities in South Sudan. For VOA News, Juliana Shiapai reports from Juba.
Whitaker, who was designated as a UNESCO Goodwill Ambassador for Peace and Reconciliation in June 2011, says he is in Juba to meet stakeholders, government officials, and listen to beneficiaries of the Whitaker Peace and Development Initiative, a non-profit he established in South Sudan.
I started this organization, WPDI, about almost 11 years ago, and I need to always take stock in what's going on. We have a great executive director, Carolyn Descombrice, but I want to see things and always see things. So I've been here many, many, many times, all the way through most of our trainings. So it's a way for me to be able to connect and know that we're still on the right track.
The Hollywood actor says he is also in Juba to show solidarity with partners who continue to support his dream. The program manager of the Whitaker Peace and Development Initiative, Dagu David, says Whitaker's visit reinforces the vision of encouraging young people to become agents of peace in their community.
In 2022 alone, we have graduated just from the community learning centers, 1,072. This is across the network of the 8 community centers that we have in Yambio, Maridi, Juba, Torit, Chukudum, Nimule, Lafon. And we operate these community learning centers in far-flung areas, places that are far removed and cut off from sometimes mainstream services. So our community learning centers have been acting as hubs of learning where people get information, people get to learn and access opportunities.
David adds that the Whitaker Peace and Development Initiative trains young men and women in peace building and conflict resolution who could become the first respondent to address existing or emerging conflict in their community. Grace Laponi is a graduate from the Whitaker Peace and Development Initiative and is currently an active trainer of trainees. She says her team trained more than 300 young men and women across the 4 counties of Central Equatoria State last year.
We established peace clubs in both primary and secondary schools and train over 2,500 students and pupils on conflict resolution education. We conducted several successful community dialogues across Central Equatorial State aimed at reconciling and building trust among the frequent communities, e.g. the Goja Dialogue in Yei, the Goik Dialogue in Lanya, Liria Dialogue in Juba, Tali Dialogue in Terkeka, and many others.
The White Taker Peace and Development Initiative is equipping young men and women in South Sudan with skills of engaging in community dialogue, conflict resolution education, ICT, business and entrepreneurship. White Taker is expected to be joined by government officials this week to flag off a sports tournament aimed at promoting peace and social cohesion. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shiapai in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a veteran Ugandan journalist petitions the country's High Court. Find out why after the break.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni on Monday signed into a law tough new anti-LGBTQ legislation supported by many in Uganda, but widely condemned by rights activists and others abroad. 11 activists petitioned the Constitutional Court seeking to block its implementation. The petitioners want, among others, for the court to issue a permanent injunction against the implementation of the law. One of the petitioners is Andrew Mwenda, a journalist and a founder of The Independent, a Kampala-based current affairs news magazine.
Well, I feel like Museveni signed it in order to respond to public demand, because I know him personally and have personally discussed issues of homosexuality with him. Museveni has a much more progressive position on homosexuality than 99% of his fellow Ugandans. So I think he signed out of political pressure, not out of conviction. The law itself is a very backward and barbaric law in every sense of that word, because it literally makes it a crime to even defend the rights of homosexuals. It makes it a crime to provide accommodation to homosexuals. Essentially, it declares people who are homosexual outcasts in society, who should not have access to hotels, they should not have access to housing, they should not have access to medical care, they should not have access to anything. It's just an unbelievable, preposterous.
I understand you intend to take legal action against this. Is that correct?
Yes. I am taking matter to the Constitutional Court challenge constitutionality on several grounds. One, let me begin with the field where I work. I'm a journalist, a radio talk show host, a panelist on television shows. Literally, it makes it a crime for anyone to defend homosexuality as an alternative lifestyle in life. It has provisions on promotion. Anyone who does anything that defends or promotes homosexuality has committed a crime. You go to jail for 14 years. Essentially, if you're a panelist, a scholar, whatever, you do an academic paper, speak on television, write an article, a newspaper defending gay rights, it means you have committed a crime. That's preposterous. And I am sure the Constitutional Court will not accept that it's constitutional for government to pass a law on any subject and say that subject cannot be discussed in a positive manner. That the only thing you can do on television and mass media is to condemn homosexuality. If you don't condemn it, it means you're promoting it. If you're promoting it, you go to jail for 14 years. So that is one. But the other one is invasion of privacy. They say if you rent a house or a hotel or any building to people who are homosexuals, then you have committed a crime. That's absurd. So homosexuals should not have a right to housing. The third, it says if you have any organization in any way that supports homosexuals, you have committed a crime. So even under the law, assuming you even set up a center for psychotherapy for homosexuals, or you set up a foundation to defend their rights or to provide medical care to those who need it and declare that they're homosexuals, you have committed a crime. I think this is the most retrogressive anti-homosexual law I have ever heard about in the whole world. It's like Ugandan members of parliament are nuts.
A similar law was annulled by the Constitutional Court in the past, but on technical grounds. What chances do you think this one has of being ruled unconstitutional?
You know, at that time, I was the lead petitioner. We were petitioning it, but it had been passed without quorum. So we did not deal with the substantive clauses of the law. we dealt with the procedure irregularities, how it was passed. This time, we are going to challenge the substantive provisions of the law itself, as I have told you, how it suppresses media freedom, how it invades rules of privacy, how it denies a particular section of society access to housing, access to medical care. It's so draconian, I am confident that the Constitutional Court of Uganda will throw it out.
Yes, you just said, you know, serving as a progressive leader, and knowing all the facts you just mentioned, despite the pressure he might have had, why do you think he would have had to assent to it, given that maybe it can't stand constitutionality test?
I did not say that Museveni is a progressive leader generally. I said on matters of homosexuality, Museveni has a progressive position, because if you speak to him, he makes 2-3 points which I find fundamental that set him apart from most Africans I debate this issue with. Museveni says, one, that homosexuality existed in pre-colonial African society. That's a very important point, because many Ugandans say homosexuality is being promoted by Western countries in Uganda. The second thing Museveni argues is that pre-colonial African societies did not persecute homosexuals. They knew the practice existed, they did not condemn it, and they did not persecute homosexuals. So that is a very progressive position. Again, it challenges the dominant view by many Africans across the entire continent who say it's an African. The third, Museveni says that the homosexuals practice their homosexuality quietly, just like straight people practice their sexuality privately. I find that a progressive position. So on those three points, I feel he stands apart. Now, why then could a person with such a progressive view sign such a draconian law? I feel like Museveni, having been in the power for 38 years, his government has grown old and tired. It has lost credibility. He knows the general Ugandan population is homophobic. He does not want to take a position which contradicts the general feelings and sentiments and biases and prejudices of the voting population. So he assented to it because he doesn't want to antagonize voters. We have an election in 2.5 years, and I don't think he would want to be on the wrong side of voters. So he was really expressing his political vulnerability rather than his ideological beliefs in assenting to this law.
That's Andrew Mwenda, a journalist and a founder of The Independent, a Kampala-based current affairs magazine. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpogwa from Kampala. A UN special rapporteur has voiced concerns about the worsening situation in Zimbabwe, where a number of human rights defenders and opposition activists are facing charges, with some in jail. The call comes as the country prepares for elections in August, and as the nation awaits for President Emmerson Mnangagwa to announce a date for the polls. Columbus Mavunga has this report from Harare.
In an interview from her base in Geneva by WhatsApp, Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights Defenders, Mary Nole, says the number of human rights activists facing charges ahead of Zimbabwe's elections is concerning.
I'm very concerned about ongoing legal proceedings against human rights defenders, because they are people who are peacefully working for the rights of others. It is legitimate, credible work. There should be no criminalization, no arrest, no torture of human rights defenders. And that includes freedom of expression, freedom of association, and working for those who are marginalized.
Nole says the Zimbabwean government should drop the charges and release those who have been jailed. Obed Masaraure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, which fights for rights of educators that work in rural areas. He is facing charges of inciting public violence, obstructing justice, subversion, and murder, but has been released on bail. He says that despite the charges, he will not budge.
It is not proper for Emmerson Mnangagwa to continue persecuting people through prosecution. The ongoing lawfare against citizens who are viewed as enemies of Mnangagwa should stop now. Zimbabwe is not Mnangagwa's tuck shop. Mnangagwa should learn to respect our fundamental rights as defined in the Constitution. The charges I face today, four of them, they all violate my basic rights. They violate my freedom of expression, the one on posting on Twitter. They violate my freedom to petition duty bearers. They are all ridiculous charges that are meant to silence us. And we demand an end to this persecution and full observance of the people's rights as defined in our Bill of Rights.
He called for the release of jailed opposition activists such as Job Skala and Jacob Garuvume before the general election, a date for which has not been set by President Mnangagwa. In a response for request for an interview from VOA, Nick Mangwana, Zimbabwe's Information Ministry Secretary, said, as government, we do not interfere with the criminal justice system. Lole also wants the elections to be peaceful.
The vote must be free and fair, and the election observers should be allowed to do their work without any kind of stopping them in any way. Also, the election process should be completely transparent from start to finish.
Zimbabwe's past elections have been marred by violence and accusations of a lack of transparency. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday. We now leave you with Emmanuel Kembe and the song Kafara Lesiasa.
Kalina kesi musa wa Por lokal kabiru hilu Vitamin katiru vipoku Kalina kesi musa wa We adala Api eita nyar kuta junub Ishamal barakazal Aplev riva kir Will be free Thanks to Igat Machakos, thanks to Nakuru, thanks to Nyanyuki, Shukuran Jazil and Lenny Basha, Lakin Yakama Bizip Mashakil, Mashakil Bijip Mutukatir, Umutukatir Kusara, Kusara Lena. God bless our leaders. Give them more wisdom. Lead us to our destination. And bless everyone who had put it together. To let the sun shine bright in Sudan. Vitamin katir vipoku Kalina kesi musa wa We adala Apie danyar kuta junub Vishamal barakazal Aplev riva kim Will be free Thanks to Igat Thanks to Machakos Thanks to Nakuru
We've been listening to Emmanuel Kembe and the song Kefaya, which is an Arabic word for enough. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Kayla Williams, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
And bless everyone who helped put it together to let the sun shine bright in Sudan.